Welcome to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. This podcast is for those who are committed to thriving no matter where they are on that journey. And I say journey because thriving is not about achievement. It is not a destination. It's about engagement. It's about being energized by our life. My name is Bobby Kaler, and I'm your host. And I'm so excited to be on this journey with you. I mentioned that it's a journey, and you might find yourself anywhere along that path. You may be starting out, you may be mid-career, or you may be considering your next career. You might be an entrepreneur or a salesperson, or you may be that person who just feels like something's calling to you and it's time for a change. My mission is to provide stories that inspire us so that when challenges show up, we will choose to persist. I will also provide practical skills, perspectives, and ideas that will help us create the habits of thriving and flourishing. Because at the end of the day, it is all about providing hope, knowledge, and assurance that we can all be more fulfilled and successful if we choose. Let's dive in to today's episode. My guest today epitomizes being fueled by purpose. She understands the challenges of making her dreams come true. She was a co-founder and the director of communications and development at the Dragonfly Home, a nonprofit in Oklahoma City serving victims of human trafficking. She is an attorney, a writer, and a seasoned speaker. Her podcast, Making Your Impact, inspires and equips you to pursue your calling and make your positive impact on the world. Her name is Melissa Ike, and I cannot wait for you to meet her. Melissa, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Bobby.
I am so excited about this interview. I've been thinking about since the first time we talked and kind of looking at my notes. And one thing that really stands out is that your path has really been, I would say, purpose-driven. And I was wondering, would you mind sharing a little bit about your journey and where you are now and what led you to where you are now?
Sure. That's a big question. And I'm like, how long can I speak and just keep going on? Yeah, I think that having purpose in life has always been important to me. Even looking back when I was a kid, that was super important to me. Very cause driven. So I guess my journey and the way that I came to know you was through a friend of mine, a fellow French major at the University of Northern Iowa, and he introduced us. I studied French because it just seemed like being a part of something bigger to me. I honestly wasn't sure that was one way in which I was not purpose-driven, but I was drawn to it, and I'd always been passionate about languages. So I just went with it. And that caused me to learn a lot about just other cultures around the world, especially Francophone cultures. And that's like parts of Africa, the Caribbean, some parts of the Middle East, and what women and girls experienced there, what they'd gone through. It just opened my eyes to so many parts of the world I hadn't seen before. I think that really lit a fire in me, or stoked the fire that probably already been there, for really wanting to do something for the cause of women and young girls, was to kind of counteract a lot of oppression that we've suffered throughout the ages. So I think that ended up being a huge step for me. And then I just kept taking step after step. And I suppose to a lot of people, it might look like some odd steps that might not seem connected, but they all follow kind of like that heart line, I guess you could say. They all center around that. So I went on and pursued French for several years, got my master's, taught some college French, lived in France for a year. And then surprisingly, it was while I was in France and witnessing a demonstration. So French culture is known for protesting a lot, and they actually get some things accomplished. So I was seeing all these demonstrations and this fleeting thought went through my head, I wonder what the French laws say about this kind of protest and how people are able to take off work. I wonder if going to law school would help me learn that. And I thought, that's the worst idea I've ever had. I was like, this is leading me astray. I remember that moment so clearly in December 2005.
That's amazing.
The next 2 years, I prayed and I was like, this is bad. And finally, at some point in 2007, I finally prayed, God, whatever is on my heart that is not from you, take it away. And then law school was the only thing left. And I was like, dang it, that really backfired on me. And so I was, and so what's interesting is once I leaned into it, while I was still nervous about law school, which is a reasonable reaction. I did have more peace. I gotta say, I had that weird peace that doesn't make any sense. That is how I wound up going to the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'd been in, lived in Iowa my whole life. I didn't know anyone in Tulsa, but I visited, and once again, I remember these exact moments when I just knew that that's where I was supposed to go. I just got an overwhelming sense of peace there, which you're really not supposed to get about law school. Peace. So I went to law school and I worked hard, but there was tremendous grace. I was able to, law school actually, so unexpectedly, is where I first heard about human trafficking. My first semester, a few weeks in, I went to a club lunch. They were offering free lunch. And it's the only time I went to this particular club. And they were showing a documentary produced by MTV about sex trafficking in Eastern Europe. And that was really the start of where I am today. I mean, honestly, I kind of trace it back to that moment in France in 2005 to where I am today. But step after step after step, that moment was the turning point for my calling. And I remember we'd gotten these nice sub sandwiches and we sat down to watch this thing. And when the lights came on, I don't know, half an hour, 45 minutes later, I hadn't even taken a bite because I was so engrossed by what I was seeing. And from that point on, my whole mission switched. And, you know, I went through law school, started practicing, but this subject of human trafficking is like, I couldn't get away from it. And so a few years after law school, I finally admitted that I had to do something about this cause. So I started learning, I started taking small steps, and then those steps became bigger. I got involved with some organizations, volunteering in different ways. And then in 2016, I'm like so fast forwarding. This is what I mean. I could talk about all these little moments and things that happened along the way. 2016, I co-founded a nonprofit in Oklahoma City called the Dragonfly Home with two women whom I had met while volunteering. And I became the director of communications and development for Dragonfly. We got state certified, which is required in Oklahoma to serve trafficking victim survivors in November 2016. And so now we're coming up on 4 years and we've served hundreds of people, victim survivors of sex and or labor trafficking of all genders, some juveniles, mostly adults. We also operate a 24-hour human trafficking helpline that's received just thousands of calls. And we also engage in community outreach. And so in all sorts of different ways, we've reached all different communities, schools, trying to reach everyone we can virtually, in person, through our social media to try and reach people, which results in both prevention efforts and then also results in people coming up to us and saying, I didn't realize it, but I was actually trafficked and I didn't know that's what had happened to me until today. So then we're able to offer help to those individuals. And I can tell you, I can't tell you specifically, but some other big things are on the horizon. Right now we operate a human trafficking crisis center, which is a non-residential program. But we have a brand new program that was just announced since I last talked to you.
Wow.
We got grant funding to work with an organization here to provide some independent transitional type housing scattered throughout the city for trafficking survivors and their children, that they can work with us and this other organization called Upward Transitions to determine what their needs are, where they need to live, what type of housing they need. And Bobby, that's not even the last of it. There's more, but I just can't tell you quite yet. It's never ending. So there you go. I tried to put it in as much a nutshell as I could.
No, that's great. I mean, and congratulations on the new grant. That's going to help even more people.
That's right.
Now, Melissa, did you say that club meeting, that was the only club meeting that you had gone to?
It was a club meeting of the International Law Society. I did end up getting a certificate in international and comparative law. And so I thought, I'll check out this group. And they just kind of didn't do a whole lot. But that one time that I went, they showed that documentary. And
that was
the only time I even stepped foot in their club.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I know when we talked before, you said once you saw that video or that film, that it just wouldn't let you go.
That's right. Yeah, the way I see it in my mind, and I'm not sure if this communicates to others well, but it's like if I'm walking along a path and I'm like, I'm going to practice law now because that's what I was trained to do in law school. It's almost like, what would it be? Like a giant weather balloon or something just kind of like following me along. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And pretty soon I can't see much of anything else except this thing that just kind of won't let go, won't stop following me. So finally I just have to stop and address it. And when I did, it was amazing how quickly things fell into place. Not that it's been easy. There's been a lot of sacrifice and hard work along the way, but there again, underlying all of that is this sense of peace and knowing that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
You were probably exposed to a lot of different things in law school. What was it about human trafficking that just kind of grabbed you and wouldn't let go?
You know, it was years later that I finally figured out what that was. I don't even know if I could have told you, but just back at the beginning of 2016, just months before we founded Dragonfly, but I didn't know. I had no idea that was going to happen yet. I went to a little coffee shop here to do some journaling, and I'd been reading a book by a woman named Teresa Flores about her experience being trafficked, sex trafficked in, I think, the 90s. I was reading that book and then I, you know, finished that and I was just kind of sitting there journaling and I had this sense of almost being tapped on the shoulder, like, hey, pay attention right now. And I'm like, oh, okay. I have my journal, I have my pen, I'm poised, I'm ready to go. And I suddenly realized this word, this idea of freedom came to my mind and everything clicked for me. This idea of having the freedom, especially for women and girls, trafficking happens to boys and men as well, but that's where it started for me. This idea of being free to be who you are, to pursue the life that you want, to know your purpose and have the freedom to pursue that. If it's education or if you want to have a family or not have a family, what job you want to have, but being free to live the life you want. And I realized that, and free also from things like bullying, free to appreciate yourself, to have self-esteem, to think highly of yourself, not in an arrogant way, but to have a healthy sense of self-worth. And in that moment, I kind of could look back and see this connection between things that had been important to me for a really long time. And so I think that's where it comes from. I mean, that seems maybe obvious that freedom would be important to someone who is fighting human trafficking. But when I've told other people about this who are equally passionate about it, it's different for them. They might be drawn to it because of something else. Yeah, but this idea of this personal freedom, the being allowed to live the life that you want to live, I think, and then the utter injustice and inhumanity of depriving that from someone, of stealing it from them to the point of controlling every aspect of their lives and forcing them to do something like have sex with others or engage in grueling physical labor just for someone else's greed and profit. I think that being just standing in just total opposition to what was important to me. I think that's it. That was really the root of that calling.
Yeah. And when you first started talking, you said even as a kid that you felt like you were driven by purpose. I'm just kind of curious, how did that show up as a kid?
Well, it's funny you should mention it. When I talked to you before, I mentioned to you that I was in the process of writing a memoir of sort. And just in these last few weeks, I've really been honing in on these chapters about like my childhood through high school years. And I thought, this really is true about me. Even like the things that I would play as a child, one of my earliest memories is being super into She-Ra, which has recently resurfaced as a new series, but I was old school She-Ra. And, you know, when I went back to research research almost my own life, I thought, gosh, I don't even really remember what She-Ra was about. That cartoon was literally about this woman who had been kidnapped at birth, taken to another planet that was enslaved. And she was like under a spell, a magical spell, and was like helping, you know, the captor get set free. And then her whole mission is with her and like a kooky band of misfit ragtag rebels, you know, in a very 80s cartoon style, go and free slaves. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? Yeah. I just didn't even. So anyway, so then from that point on, I was always seeking out, I was learning about different causes throughout history. When I was 9 or 10 years old, this was the early 90s. And so the cause of environmentalism was becoming more widespread. And I was a little environmentalist. I wrote a puppet show about like recycling for neighborhood kids. I hadn't even remembered that until I really thought about it. I corralled some friends into putting together an earth fair where we raised like $25 for Greenpeace with handmade booths and games. I was really badly bullied in school, but I volunteered. I asked my teacher if I could do a presentation about saving the earth for all of these little jerks, kids that were bullying me. And I think she was like, okay,
go ahead.
And all I remember is being in front of them and they were all just like listening to me in that moment. Like they were listening. And I think, by the way, I do a lot of public speaking. It's one of my favorite things. I think it's an inherent thing that I just enjoy. And that's like my first memory of really engaging in public speaking about something I was passionate about. And even these kids, these little snot-nosed kids, who are probably perfectly fine today, but were very mean to me, couldn't help but pay attention. And when I was going through all that, I thought that's just bananas. That, I mean, I could even go on about more stuff. Those are just some highlights. Yeah. And then
that's cool.
Right. Such an odd kid. but I mean, I did what I wanted to do. And in high school, I was super involved in like speech and debate and all kinds of other stuff. But I had this opportunity to do a service project for a scholarship. And I did a fundraiser for the AIDS Project of Central Iowa because I was super inspired by the musical Rent. And I looked back at it and I thought, I raised like $4,200 for this nonprofit in 1998.
That's amazing.
Right. I was like, here at Dragonfly today, if some high school kid just decided they were going to do that for us, we would be bowled over. I don't think I ever thought that it was that big of a deal. And it is all this stuff that I'm doing in my job so often now, every day, is what I just decided to up and do when I was 17 years old. So those are just a few examples. I really have always been, I was just born this way. You know?
Yeah. But no, that's amazing. And it's also really interesting to hear how many different ways it has shown up for you.
Right.
You know, now, earlier you said, follow the heart line. What did you mean by that?
You know, I don't know if I have ever actually put it that way or thought of it that way until right now. I see myself like, I guess in my mind, I guess I'm into abstract visuals today is the theme of my day today. Just kind of like if I'm following a string and it's connected to something and that string is consistent, but maybe the string like goes in like the a bunch of different directions, but I'm just kind of like holding the string and just kind of like following along. The string itself is like, it's all the same theme, right? Mm-hmm. It's serving people. It's wanting to make a positive difference. It's wanting to help people who are oppressed in some way, which I really think the cause of environmentalism plays into that as well. Just following along that thread, but the path it takes me on looks like French major and law school, and now I live in Oklahoma. And so from the outside, those don't seem connected at all, but they have all brought me to these really critical points throughout mm-hmm. my life to get me to where I am today. And I look at where I am today and I think, man, if I could go back 25 years ago and tell myself, hey, this is what we're going to do in 25 years, I really think that my little like early teen self would be really happy about that. It makes me happy to think of her and following that little string, that heart line.
Yeah. I love that. And I'm sure she'd be thrilled, right?
I hope so. I think so.
Yeah. And so Melissa, that brings up a really good question though. How do you tune into and heed, I guess, what's in your heart?
Mm-hmm. Well, I am a person of faith. And that has, you know, I would hold up Jesus as to be a model of how to treat people. And, you know, he really stood for freedom and justice and treating people well and calling out injustice. And I'm sure as heck not perfect at emulating him. I don't know very many people who are in our own
That's
ways,
right.
but That's the example that I would want. I'm like, man, if I can just try and show that love to the world. And all throughout the Bible is language about speaking life to people, freedom for those who are oppressed, speaking light into darkness. It's really everywhere. And so that I would say my faith has definitely informed what I'm talking about to you today. And as far as that voice, I think it really just takes practice. And for me, that definitely looks like prayer, but it also looks like training ourselves to be silent and really listening for it. I know that probably looks different for everyone, whatever their view on faith is or however they want to look at that. But that I can go back to that. So when I was mentioning earlier about this sense of peace, there is a verse in the Bible. I think it's Colossians 3:15 or 16, one of those. And I really like the way one translation puts it. It says, let peace be the umpire of your heart. And again, ooh. I like the visual of that. So
yeah.
I'm imagining like a baseball field. And if peace is the umpire, it's either saying out or safe. In all of these big decisions, sometimes I am very aware of it and I literally am like, okay, I'm going to shut up now. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to be quiet and I'm going to listen. Sometimes that's been necessary. But over the years, I think as I've gotten more attuned to being aware of that, I think I can usually hear it more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And what has never failed me is waiting for that sense of peace. If the peace is not there, I'm going to hold off on making a decision or maybe make the opposite decision. But when I have pursued that peace, it's taken me on a wild ride. It definitely doesn't look like, oh, I'm following peace. And so it will be the gentle, mild way of living life. That has definitely not been the case. There's been tons of risks, tons of steps of faith. But I'm still here. I'm mm-hmm. still doing what I'm doing, and more opportunities just keep lining up on the horizon as I go.
Yeah. I love that interpretation. That is just perfect. That's a great visual. Because earlier you had said when you were praying about law school and you said something like, God, anything that's not from you, take it away. And it sounded like kind of peace was your indicator there.
Yeah. Yeah, it really sucks in the moment when the thing you have the peace about is the thing you don't really want to do. But you're like, ugh. And then when I've tried to pretend that that peace wasn't there about this decision and like try and take other steps, I just have felt so awful inside. It's the weirdest thing to describe. Nothing's going wrong outwardly. I'm not sick. I'm not. It's just this gross feeling inside. Mm-hmm. And when I finally turn in the direction that I know that's leading me, I feel so much better, even if it's not the easiest direction.
Yeah. I think that you had even told me when we talked before, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think you said something like, for a while after law school, it was like a bit of a challenge or a struggle. And then as soon as you made the decision to turn towards the fighting human trafficking, like everything just opened up.
That's right. No, you're absolutely right. It was a really hard time. Someone who school is nice for me because there are clear goalposts, there are achievements to be had. I know the direction I'm going. I can reach these certain benchmarks and know my purpose. And so when I was done with that and then kind of adrift, it was a really difficult time for 2 years. And so I knew that this human trafficking thing was there, but nothing was really working out for me. And I didn't think that that was real. It wasn't even on my mind to really pursue anything about that. I was like, okay, that's important, but I got to get a job as a lawyer, which I did not want, by the way. I didn't want a job at a law firm. I didn't want to be a traditional lawyer. And I always knew that going in, but you get on a conveyor belt. That's what law schools are. And that's okay. You know, that's what they're for. But it just wasn't supposed to be my path. But so I was trying to like fit in. It was a really hard time. And so then, it was like pretty much exactly 2 years after law school that I went home to be inducted into the Iowa bar. I had already taken the Virginia one. This was the Iowa bar. I went there and had a conversation with my parents, and they knew I'd been struggling. And so they asked me point blank, well, what do you want to do? And I remember sitting there and I said, I want to like be a speaker about human trafficking, a million question marks, because I didn't know if that was even a thing. I had no idea how to go about it. Mm-hmm. I just had this vague notion in my head. And I remember they just stared at me for a second and they said, well, why haven't you said anything about this before? And I said, well, because it feels very dumb. I don't even know what it is. I don't even know if it's an option. And so I just started after that, just learning, taking some steps, finding out about different organizations. And finally, on August 7th, 2013, I invited a bunch of friends over, these women who have all the craft supplies, rubber stamps and papers and glitter and markers and all the things you could ever hope for. I invited them to my apartment and we crammed around a table and we made a bunch of handmade greeting cards and these masterpieces of greeting cards. And then me and a few of my friends, we took to writing encouraging notes in them and I shipped them off to some shelters I knew about in Greece, Ukraine, and Bulgaria, because I'd heard that that was something we could do. And I thought, I know how to make greeting cards, so I will do that. And that very night, a friend of mine who I happened to connect with on chat very late at night, it has never happened since, had heard about an organization. And she said, you know, in like the Oklahoma area. And so, no, actually, she didn't even know that it was in the Oklahoma area. They were operating in Africa. And she just wanted to tell me about it because she knew I was interested. And their headquarters was in Oklahoma City. And like, that was a big moment. I started attending volunteer meetings for that organization. Then I met some people in Tulsa where I was living at the time and started doing some legal stuff for this nonprofit. There was a local church organization. I started doing stuff with them a little bit at a few different meetings. And it just started, it opened these doors to start using my skills in different ways. And then I started volunteering as a social media coordinator for a nonprofit in Oklahoma City. That's where I met these, my two Dragonfly co-founders. And I worked, you know, doing these different things over the years. And then finally moved to Oklahoma City. And that's when myself and these other two co-founders just seeing gaps in services for trafficking victim survivors here in the city, decided to start our own thing, start Dragonfly, start this non-residential crisis center where we could serve, where men wouldn't be excluded from receiving services because they can't get into a shelter, where labor trafficking victims can get help, not just sex trafficking. And it opened doors. It is amazing to me how quickly it has grown. I've been there for every step of the way, and I still can't believe. And yeah. It just started with trying to go back to what your question actually was. It just started, yeah, with that decision. I know that probably won't happen for everyone, but actually I really believe that when we make a decision and to pursue what's in our hearts, doesn't mean it's going to happen overnight, but when we don't give up and just keep pursuing it and take little steps as we can, here it is, yeah. 7 years later. I never in that moment could have believed where I would be all these years later.
Yeah. And Melissa, there's so much good stuff in there, but there's two things that really are, it's like screaming out to me. And one is when you're describing that, like once you started getting involved and you did note cards and you volunteered here and there, and you said this earlier, you know, a bunch of small steps that eventually led to bigger steps. Yeah. And I think sometimes, you know, to your point, people maybe have a calling in their heart, but they don't know, like, well, how could it look or, you know, whatever. And the second thing, and I think this is huge too, I'm a little bit older than you are. And I also was in speech and debate in high school and I loved it. Nice. Like I always thought I could debate anybody, anytime, anywhere on any topic. And I loved it.
Right.
And I remember talking to my guidance counselor and she said, well, you know, there's basically two things you could do with that. You could become an attorney or you could go into journalism. And I'm like, but I don't know if I want to do either one of those things.
Right.
And, you know, I think that when your parents asked you, well, what do you want to do? And you had that notion with all the question marks after it. Yeah. I think there's a lot of people who maybe they have that inkling, but they don't know, well, what could it actually be or what could it actually look like? Yeah. You know, and I love that you just started like immersing yourself in it.
That's really, I think, what it is. You're just not going to know. You're just not going to know. You can even have let's say you have a super clear vision of exactly what you want to do, but to get from point A to point B could involve all sorts of steps you couldn't expect. And by the time you get to point B, it looks so different than what you imagined. But you have to be willing to take the small steps. And I've met people who get frustrated because they try to get involved with something and they're not immediately in charge or their ideas are not immediately taken up by the leadership to change everything. And to me, like they might think that they have a really big vision, but to me, it's pretty short-sighted. If you're going to go and start getting involved, no matter what it is, you have to realize that no matter how much research you've done online, which is a good place to start, when it comes to actually taking practical steps to practically get involved, there's going to be more to learn. And there's aspects that you are not privy to at the beginning. And it takes, you know what? It takes some humility and humbling yourself to serve where you can. And I mean, that was my story. My two Dragonfly co-founders, that was their story. Just, okay, I want to get involved somehow. One of my co-founders wanted to, this is funny, she was going to go to a class to help this nonprofit who was having a big fundraising event. She was going to go and learn how to fold napkins into swans. And that's how she was going to volunteer her time to help them prepare for this event. Instead, she accidentally got shuffled into a different room, the incorrect room, where she was learning about how to volunteer in a shelter. And then she became program director. But you know, but she was willing to do whatever she could. Another one of my co-founders started out volunteering for a similar event, and she made a bunch of cake pops for the event because she knew how. and they needed desserts. And so she said, I can make K-pops. And they're like, okay. She's the executive director of That's Dragonfly right. now. And so we've all, and we would all have that same mentality, of there's so always so much to learn. Now we've all been in it, and they've been in it longer than me by a couple of years. We're still learning. We're constantly learning. And these big strides we've made all came from taking small steps. And the thing is, when you take small steps and you have a heart to serve where you can, the people who are in charge, you build trust, you build credibility, mm-hmm. you learn more about the organization step by step because you're going to be invited to participate more. And you never know where that can go. I look at some of the people who are some of our most depended upon volunteers and who've just been with us or are with us for a season as they're able to be and you know, come and go because everybody's lives change, you know.
That's right.
But they have been amazingly helpful and what I would say about every single one of these individuals is they just want to help however they can. And so then we really trust them with what we're doing and to get involved further.
Yeah. And I think that one of the themes that I've heard on so many of these podcasts that I've done so far is a thing about humility and showing up just with that willingness to serve versus making it all about you, you know, because like your friend who was, you know, going to show up to learn how to fold napkins and swans or whatever, it would have been so easy for someone like that to be like, well, come on, you could use me better than that. But if that's what's needed, then that's what we do in that moment. So I love that. Mm-hmm. And you had said earlier, you said this, and I know this stood out to for me in our earlier conversation. You said taking risks versus taking steps of faith.
Okay. Well, I think that taking risks and taking steps of faith, to me, those two things go hand in hand. And this goes along with the fact that you, when you start out on this journey, you're not going to know what it looks like. And so, so let's say like for me going to law school, I just knew I needed to, and I didn't know why. And so for me, it was a huge step of faith to do that. And it was also a big risk. It was a financial risk. It was a professional risk. I was moving to a town in a state where I didn't know a single person, leaving behind people I knew very well, leaving behind comfort. But I like to incorporate the language of step of faith because a few weeks before I moved to Tulsa from Des Moines, at my church, there were visiting missionaries who had really served people very well in Mexico in a lot of different ways. And I was speaking to, it was a husband-wife team. I'm speaking to the wife and telling her, I am about to do this thing and go to law school. And I just don't know. And she brought up some song, which I don't know if I've ever even found it, by some 80s Christian person. I don't know. And this song, she said, there's this lyric that has always stayed with her. And it something like, taking a step of faith is like stepping out onto the air and finding something there.
Mm.
And then that now all these years later has really stuck with me. It's stepping into the unknown and risks are naturally going to be involved. You think we didn't take any risks when we started Dragonfly? We did not have, we had hardly any money. We didn't have big benefactors. We didn't have a foundation supporting us. Nobody knew us. We started out with enough money to apply for our 501c3 with the IRS. And that was gifted to us by family. And the three of us went without a paycheck for, I think, 14 or 15 months.
Wow.
Just getting like some family support and just getting by. And when I got that first paycheck, by the way, I thought, oh my gosh, I have been doing work in anti-human trafficking advocacy for 4 years. This is the first time I've, like full time. It was the first time I'd ever gotten paid for it. And so we built this from scratch out of nothing. And to see how far we've come, that's the thing about taking the risks and taking a step of faith is when you do that. And it's just, sometimes it's just a little step after a little step after a little step. And I guess this is a theme of our conversation today. You look back and you can't believe how far you've come. And what was absolutely nothing that you could just hold in your hand has now become this big thing. And not just that, but the lives that are impacted through it. I think that is the most incredible thing to think about. Because of also the ripple effects, we know how many people, right? We have statistics about how many people we've served, but a lot of these individuals have children who we are able to serve as well. They have other family members who we've been able to serve in conjunction with these individuals' recovery. And then how many more people are impacted beyond that? That's incalculable. And that is the true reward of following your purpose. And then what I say on my podcast a lot is I wrap up my podcast by saying the world needs you to make your impact. Literally, there are people who will not get the help they need, the negative consequences of which we may not know if we aren't willing to take these steps of faith, to do the thing. And that, I mean, honestly, it haunts me to think, what if we hadn't? I mean, from my standpoint, God's big enough that if I said no, he'd have been like, all right, I'll get someone else. But then what am I robbed of by not being a part of it? And then what? And anyway, I think that is so critically important. It's not just about taking the step of faith for your own purpose. It's about everything that can happen because of it.
And all the people that you can affect.
Yeah.
I mean, because also, Melissa, it's the people that you've served, but also like the awareness. I mean, to your point, the ripple effect, it's just massive.
Yeah. And
I think that when we talked last time, you had said like you started, well, and you just said it here, barely enough to start, like $2,500, something like that. And now you're approaching like $1 million in funding over the years. Is that right?
Pretty close. I don't know if it hasn't, I don't think it has actually broached that quite yet, but less than 4 years of being certified and starting serving, we've come pretty close to that. And, you know, like, for example, we've got our gala coming up in a month, which is going to be virtual this year because COVID. So this is our fifth annual one, and kind of a bummer because it was going to be really cool this year, but we're doing it virtually. But the first year we did that gala was in fall 2016. And I think we raised a profit of $7,500 and sold out. We were like, wow, amazing. And the next year we raised $35,000. And the year after that, it was, year three was, I think, something like $65,000. And then last year was something like, something like maybe 85,000. These numbers are all approximations because I don't remember all of them, but it was crazy the leaps that we were able to make. And then also, Bobby, just yesterday I was able to participate in a radio interview with our partners for this new grant that I was talking to you about and the new independent housing it'll allow. And the interviewer, she works for a radio station, so it's going to go out to a bunch of radio stations on the Sunday morning show this weekend. And she wasn't aware that human trafficking was a problem, even just in Oklahoma City. And so for 20-ish minutes, we were able to talk about that. I was able to talk about what it looks like here, you know, go into what Dragonfly does. And now, because one person was curious and asked questions, now more people know about that. How many more people, you know? It is interesting. It's something seemingly small can grow into something that we would never expect.
Yep. And again, it's just those small steps. And so a couple of things I'm curious about. First of all, how are you going to do a virtual gala? That's so exciting.
There are different ways to go about it. the way that we have decided on is, well, as it turns out, you know, what's so interesting is one little side note here, if I may bring me back to the virtual gala, I'll get back there. But something I would always encourage people about as well is they can learn what they need to learn. So as a French major and a lawyer, I never learned graphic design or video editing or podcast editing or how to build a website, and just out of what was needed so that we didn't have to pay someone. I am a legit graphic designer, if I do say so myself. I've built websites. I do video production with my own little meager tools that I have. And so all of that is going to help now with what we have to do for this. But we also now have partners. So we've been able to engage two professional videographers making different videos for us. One will be an original spoken word performance by a poet who is wonderful, who's written poems for us before. Another is going to be, we're telling the story of a young woman who we helped within the last year or so, and just her incredible story about what she'd experienced and then what has happened in her life since then. So it's going to be kind of a video package. So we're going to, you could do a live stream, and we considered that, but the expense is more. And also trying to also be safe with social distancing and everything. So ours is going to be pre-recorded, just like maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks before the event. And we are going to, we're going to have video packages from all sorts of different people, partners and I think volunteers, and then Whitney, the executive director, and myself kind of hosting it. And we have different things that we're going to be announcing, and we're still working on all of that, put together in about an hour and a half long presentation that we're going to put on YouTube and premiere. People can buy tickets, and then when they do, then they will get access to view that. And that's what it's going to look like. And we did a lot of research, because when COVID first happened, a lot of nonprofits were scrambling because their galas were right now, like right when it was happening. And they had to pivot very quickly. And I don't even know to what expense. I don't know if they lost out. We were able to take the contract we had for our location and just set it a year ahead, just set it a year forward. So that was a real blessing. We didn't lose any money because of it, but I feel bad. I'm sure nonprofits did. And most nonprofits don't have that margin. But anyway, so we had a lot of examples that we could look at for that. And this is what we decided to do. And, you know, it is a new challenge. I'm able to use these skills I've gained over the years and edit together all these different pieces that we're going to get. And that's what we're going to do. We are also, we have a silent auction, which we switched to using an online web-based silent auction, kind of like a bidding app, so to speak, last year. Mm-hmm. So we've already got that in place for this year. So that's excellent. That helps a lot. And that's what it's going to look like. And it is it's a big experiment, but it looks like it's going to work, and people are buying tickets already. So we're excited about that.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it goes to when the unexpected happens, and it always does.
Yeah.
We have to do something. So I know that when we spoke last time, Melissa, I had shared with you, like, human trafficking was something that it surprised me. And I think I shared how when I go to airports, especially the smaller airports, there's so many signs about it. What would you want people to know about human trafficking, just to kind of raise awareness a little bit?
What I would want them to know is to challenge what they've heard, because there are a lot of misconceptions about human trafficking that can lead us to overlook real victims of the crime and overlook the real tactics that traffickers are using to try and recruit people. So wherever you live, you may have heard rhetoric about the highway system in your state. That's big rhetoric in Oklahoma. It is also rhetoric in Iowa, where I'm from. I heard about it from my aunt who lives in South Dakota, but I've heard about it out of Pennsylvania and North Carolina and everywhere. And every state in the union thinks that they have a problem with human trafficking because of the highways that go through, or they have big highways that cross in their state, because they're thinking, well, people are bringing other people in. Well, that does happen, but what you're overlooking is that people from your state, from your city, are being sold for sex by people from your state, from your city, to purchasers who are from your state and from your city. Mm-hmm. And there's, I would say, this huge rhetoric here in Oklahoma about the highway system. We have not served of the hundreds, and not just at Dragonfly, in ways we've served victim survivors before we founded Dragonfly. We have not yet heard this usual story. Like highways may play a role in someone's recruiting, but, or in like their trafficking story, but it's not the cause. The cause is where you live. There are people there who want cheap labor, or they want to purchase illicit sex from adults mm-hmm. or from kids. And that's a harder pill to swallow, because now you have to look at the people who live around you, who you think are upstanding citizens, and realize some of these people are doing this.
That's right.
I would say another misconception is the story that you'll hear on Facebook about people getting followed around a Target or a Hobby Lobby parking lot, and everyone's like, they were going to traffic me. So what we always say is, if someone's following you, report it, because it could be for really bad reasons. You need to keep yourself safe. But in our experience, none of the people we've served, that has not been their story. We work very closely with law enforcement on different levels here. They've not heard of that being anyone's story, because it's way more insidious than this. Mm-hmm. You try to take someone out of a parking lot and they're throwing a fit and it's caught on camera and people are looking for them. Traffickers are business people. They want an efficient business model. It is way more efficient to sit behind a computer and start sending messages to tons of people, young girls, young boys, young women, young men, on Facebook, on Instagram, dating apps, using video games, putting out feelers. Can you tell someone, oh, you're so beautiful, and do they ignore you, or do they say, oh, I don't know? Mm-hmm. There's so many. That is what we've heard. That kind of thing is what we hear all the time. Someone reaching out and just giving someone a compliment who is abused, neglected, has all sorts of adverse childhood experiences in their background. Traffickers actually write manuals for what they do and sell them online. And they say, you can learn how to spot someone's desperation or vulnerability. And then all you got to do is, you know, talk to them for a few minutes and figure out what it is they need. And then you become that person for them. Mm-hmm. And then you win their trust. Now they think you love them. And then you can start gaining control. Sometimes it is through violence. There's often violence involved. But more often it's like building layer after layer of a relationship. And I would also say that people should learn about familial and intimate partner trafficking. I think what shocks people maybe the most in all these years I've been working on this is to hear how common it is for parents to sell their children for sex here in the United States. It's not just happening overseas. That has been the story of so many people we've served, a parent, a grandparent, a sibling, an aunt or uncle, for drugs, for rent, sometimes for cash, but it's often these other things, selling their children for that for years. And
that's just atrocious.
It's atrocious. It's very easily concealed.
Yeah.
So when we just look at, oh, it's the highways, or, oh, people getting snatched out of a parking lot, or, oh, it only happens to people who are overseas or bringing people here from other countries. If we only look at those things, or there was the recent conspiracy theory about Wayfair. Did you hear about that?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No.
I'm not even sure if I can fully explain it. People can go on and research it themselves. But for a few weeks, there was this conspiracy theory that there were traffickers using the Wayfair website to sell children. Just go and research it. Or not whoever wants to go and learn about it, go and research it. But everyone, we checked with our law enforcement people on the state level and on the federal level. our instincts told us that it was probably not right, but we asked around and everyone was like, no, this is a conspiracy theory. It's been debunked in several ways. And so two things came out of that. One, I would say, if people are only thinking along those lines of how trafficking happens, they're missing the person talking to their children through Facebook chat in their bedrooms right now who are trying to recruit them for human trafficking. You have to learn about these different ways that it can happen. And then if someone says to you, my husband's been selling me for sex, and you think, well, you're not a trafficking victim. That's not how that looks. That's not even how that works. Well, yes, it is. But you have you're only thinking about it through this one way. Now, I'll say this for the Wayfair conspiracy theory. What it did was it definitely got people interested in human trafficking, learning about it on their own. It concerned people. And we had lots of people reaching out to us to volunteer, to donate, to participate, to attend our gala. So it was twofold. It was like, well, okay. Yeah. If the result is that people take some legit action, then that's great. But you have to kind of move past that first step and just accepting that that's what it is to learn a little bit more.
Yeah. So to raise awareness like that. And Melissa, I think it's always easier to think that there's an outside boogeyman.
Yes.
Than that it's someone that you might go to church with or you might see at the store.
You hit the nail on the head, Bobby. That's absolutely right.
God. So Melissa, with that, if people want to learn more about what Dragonfly does, where should they go? And also tell us about your podcast too.
Okay. Yeah. The Dragonfly Homes website is thedragonflyhome.org. We've got a lot of great material on there to learn about human trafficking, some basic facts and definitions, red flags, misconceptions. So that builds on what I've been talking about, some survivor stories. We're starting to build our content about how trafficking disproportionately affects certain populations, like Black, Indigenous, people of color. We've got a section on there about how it impacts the Native American community, because there's a big Native community here in Oklahoma, and we're working on building that up. That's an important thing to know about human trafficking as well, is how racism plays into it. But listen, that is a whole other ball of wax that I could go into, and I will refrain. But do research on that, listeners. So the dragonflyhome.org. Then you can also learn about what we do, ways to get involved. Heck, if you want to attend our virtual gala, our gala tickets are just $25. Anyone anywhere in the world can attend if that's something that would interest anybody. And then you can follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, and you'll find different content on all of those as well.
Yeah.
And then go ahead.
Real quick, when is the gala and how would they find out about it?
Yeah, it is September 24th at 7 p.m. Central Time. It will be on YouTube. So when you get your ticket, then the night of the event, you'll receive a link where you can watch it. And you can go to our website. It's right on there. It's under our events, but then there's also a slider right when you click on it, you'll see about the gala. And it's just thedragonflyhome.org/gala if people want to search that out.
Nice. Nice. Thank you. And then your podcast.
My podcast is called Making Your Impact. I would say if you like Bobby's podcast, then I think that we have probably a lot of similar themes. Mm-hmm. So my tagline for my show is a podcast to inspire and equip you to pursue your calling and make your positive impact on the world, which is essentially what I've just been talking about all day. So that is very much on my heart all the time. And so there's some interviews. I go through my own stories and practical things that I have learned from doing this kind of thing for literally my whole life. And then practical ways that I try and make my life more efficient so that I free up more time. I talk about that a lot, self-care activities, freeing up psychological bandwidth, how to be productive, that kind of thing. But it all goes back to enabling us to do this thing that's on our hearts to do.
I love that. I love that. Any parting words of wisdom based on, you know, what you've learned over the years by doing the podcast or just living your life the way that you have?
My final words of wisdom would be, you can do it. Don't expect it to be easy, but don't be afraid of the sacrifice and the hard work. Take care of yourself along the way, but if there's something that you want to do, man, just start taking those little steps and you can do it. You can learn what you need to learn. You can go at the pace that you want, but it's not only crucial for you. It really might be crucial for people who come across your path in life.
Yeah. And they'd be missing out if you don't pursue it. So I love that. Melissa, thank you so much for being here and sharing everything. And best of luck with the Dragonfly. It's unfortunately such a need.
Right.
You know, so thank you.
Thank you so much, Bobby. It was really wonderful talking with you.
I hope that you enjoyed Melissa's story and that you found plenty of inspiration along the way. Here are my top takeaways. Number one, a thing you don't want to do could be an important part of your journey or purpose, even if you can't see how it contributes yet. Number two, what has taken root in your mind, like the balloon that follows you around until you must do something about it? What is it that won't let go of you? Number three, the time and space for silence, that can be the time when you hear the whispers of your calling or of something that's important to you. Those whispers are really hard to hear in the busyness of life. Therefore, we have to make time for the silence. Number four, when you want to learn, commit to meeting new people and serving in different ways. New steps and new people will appear. You have to give it time. Number five, I loved it when Melissa said that her teenage self would be proud of her today. What would make you proud today and in 10 or 20 years? Number six, peace and easy or comfortable are not the same thing. Peace is that feeling you have when you're doing something that you're meant to do. I absolutely loved it when Melissa shared the interpretation of the Bible verse, and it was, "Let peace be the umpire of your heart." When we're making a tough decision and we get to a place where there's peace in that decision, how powerful is that? Number seven, some paths and goals are clear, and that's great. Others are not, and that doesn't invalidate them. Maybe they just need a little time to be fully discovered or uncovered or nurtured. Not knowing the path is not a reason to stop or not to start in the first place. Humility, curiosity, and serving humbly can be a way to move forward when we don't actually know the steps. Number eight, starting something involves learning along the way and often sacrifice. Number nine, small steps taken continually will lead to progress and/or learning, which is also progress. Don't get discouraged by how long the journey is. Revel in the fact that you're finding your way to contribute your positive influence towards something that matters to you. When you look back, we are often amazed at how far we've come in a shorter time than we thought we could. And number 10, the world needs you to make your impact. Again, these were just some of my takeaways. I loved how Melissa relentlessly followed her purpose. And sometimes how her purpose followed her until she simply couldn't ignore it. If you found this podcast helpful, please consider subscribing as well as leaving a 5-star review below. Also, if you know of someone who could benefit from the podcast and the message that we are spreading, please tell them about it. That's why we're here. This has been the Unyielded Podcast, and I believe that thriving is not a destination. It is a process, an evolution, where we are continuing to expand who we are. It's how we flourish and how we can direct our energy into a place of positive influence. My life's work is to change the world for the better, one life at a time. I hope that you'll help me do that by sharing the word.